Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Rebecca Ganetsky, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania and an attending physician in the Division of Human Genetics and Genomics at CHOP, is with us to share lactic acid and mitochondrial disease when there's too much of a good thing. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm the Patient Support Coordinator at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcast, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. The chat section is for you to talk with other families and clinicians who are in the space today, but it is really helpful if you put all of your questions for the presenter in the Q&A section and not the chat. It helps me to stay a bit better organized when we kick off our Q&A time at the end of today's presentation. We will do our best to get through as many questions as possible. Today, Dr. Ganetsky will discuss how lactic acid is an essential metabolite in our body, helping to move energy from tissues that generate it to the tissues that need it the most. We will talk about what lactic acid is supposed to do and how it gets dysregulated in mitochondrial disease. Without further ado, I would like to introduce Dr. Rebecca Ganetsky. Dr. Ganetsky is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania and an attending physician in the Division of Human Genetics and Genomics at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's passionate about building biochemical diagnostic tools to help identify, prognosticate, and monitor patients with inborn disorders of energy metabolism. She has special clinical interests in primary lactic acidosis, disorders of pyruvate and tricarboxylic acid metabolism, mitochondrial ATP synthesis deficiency, and Pearson syndrome. Dr. Ganetsky graduated magna cum laude from Oberlin College with a BA in biology and computer science. She received a medical degree from the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine of Case Western Reserve University and completed a pediatrics clinical genetics combined residency and a clinical biochemical genetics fellowship at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Ganetsky, I started following your work several years ago after a patient mentioned you during a support call, and I was trying to better understand lactic acidosis. Your ability to discuss and explain the subject matter to both patients and clinicians is always meaningful and amazing. So thank you so much for all you do and your hard work and for joining us today, to discuss lactic acidosis.
Thank you so much for having me. I actually love talking about lactic acid, and I was so delighted to have the invitation. And I think the reason that I really enjoy talking about lactic acid so much is that I both really I think that it's a really misunderstood molecule that can help both healthy people and people with mitochondrial disease in so many ways. And it also presents challenges that have to be managed. So, my goal for today is to answer questions. So, like, why do we have lactate? Why does it get high? What controls that? Is it good or bad? How can we understand why lactate is high? What tools do we have to understand that? And then what management tools do we have when the lactate is too high? So, what is lactate good for anyway? To take you all the way back to the beginning, we burn food to capture its electrons and make energy. I started learning to describe the electron transport chain that way a few years ago, and I loved it. It makes so much sense to me. So, food that we eat breaks down into metabolites. They have electrons. We burn or oxidize those metabolites. We capture the electron in NADH. And then ultimately, that electron from NADH goes into complex one. It restores NAD, and that electron powers the rest of the electron transport system, which I've drawn here as a box that makes ATP. Happy to talk about what's inside that box at another moment in time. It's not really relevant right now. The point is, we capture this electron in NADH, and it helps us make ATP. If you're not familiar with NAD and NADH, I really think of them as little electron storage devices. NAD is ready to accept an electron, and NADH already has an electron stored. You could also think of them like rechargeable batteries. NADH is your charged battery, and NAD plus is a battery that needs to be recharged. Cool. We make most of our NADH. The majority of the metabolites that we burn for energy come from glucose. Glucose goes through glycolysis. That makes a little bit of NADH in our cytosols, and it becomes pyruvate. Pyruvate enters the mitochondria, and then it enters the TCA cycle, where it makes a lot of NADH. It also directly feeds complex two of the TCA cycle by generating fumarate in the TCA cycle. So that's amazing. We love glucose making energy for us, but glucose can also make lactate sometimes. So then the question that we have together is why, and I'm going to switch over to the laser pointer, I'm sorry about that. Why do we sometimes make energy, NADH, from pyruvate, and other times we don't make energy, we make lactate, and actually we consume NADH to do that, right? So we're consuming one of our rechargeable batteries to make lactate instead of making energy and charging more batteries. Why would we ever do that? Why is this a good idea? Well, metabolism happens in space. And so now I've drawn you this. I've said this is what happens inside a cell, but I'm going to give that cell an identity. Let's say that's your liver cell. Well, your liver is in a little bit of a conundrum. The job of your liver is to provide. Your liver provides energy and nutrients for the whole rest of your body, especially your brain and your muscles. But the liver has rules that it has to follow. And one of those rules is that electrons cannot leave a cell, and NAD and NADH cannot leave a cell. So the liver somehow has to figure out how to get energy to all these other cells while playing by the rules. And lactate is how it does that. So it takes the energy, it consumes its own charge batteries to instead store the energy, store the electron in lactate. Lactate is allowed to leave the liver. It leaves through a transporter called the monocarboxylate transporter 4. It goes into your blood. It's not trying to be in the blood. The blood doesn't really care about lactate. It is trying to use the blood as a travel system through which it can get to other places like brain and muscle. And then brain and muscle oxidize that lactate, they burn it, and they are able to recapture that energy, which in this case is a little pink ball or an electron, into NADH, recreating pyruvate, and then using that pyruvate to make a ton of NADH and fumarate and feed the electron transport system in the brain or muscle. So the point of lactate is so that it can help energize beyond just our liver, our brain, our muscle, the tissues that need it the most. And this is a two-way street. So if you're a muscle, you're like, well, fine, I have some glucose because I'm a muscle. I have glycogen, so I have my own glucose that I can use. I'm going to make energy. Everything's fine. But as all of us know, sometimes we like to do anaerobic exercise, like sprinting or all-out exercise is what it's called in the literature. When we do that, we don't have oxygen circulating to these muscles. And without oxygen, you can't use the oxidative phosphorylation system of the mitochondria to make ATP because you need the oxygen to do the oxidation. So without it, the mitochondria are not making ATP. And so then this NADH is actually telling you a really important message. It's accumulating, it's building up. These charge batteries are building up, and they're not actually making energy that the cell can use. So, what does the cell realize? The cell realizes, gosh, I have too much NADH. Let me use some of that to restore NAD plus and make lactate at the same time from the pyruvate. And that's good. That's a good message for the cell to get. Because, oops, wrong way. Lactate can also leave the muscle through the monocarboxylate transporter 1. It can go back into the liver. The liver now is going backwards. It turns that lactate back into pyruvate, but instead of shunting that pyruvate into its own energy production system and making energy from the liver is another thing it can do with that pyruvate. That's called gluconeogenesis. It can make glucose from the lactate and send that glucose back to the muscle so that the muscle can continue to use glycolysis to make energy. Glycolysis doesn't make a ton of energy, but it makes some energy, and it's the main source of energy in cells that don't have oxygen. I've portrayed this as a very positive thing. We're sprinting, we're doing all-out exercise, but this is also why lactate is high when people are really sick, when they have hypoxia, when they're septic and the tissues aren't getting oxygen. And this is actually also, as a pediatrician, a very common reason why lactate is high, because someone has tied a tourniquet around this arm trying to get some blood out, and the kid is fighting, and that arm doesn't have any oxygen as they're fighting with the phlebotomist to try to not have their blood drawn, and the lactate is getting higher and higher and higher because of this. So, what happens? Lactate is the way we feed exercising muscle. So, this is for the clinicians on the call, many of you have sent me an email about someone and their lactate after exercise. I probably sent you this figure back. This comes from an article in 2007. And these are healthy individuals who did 60 seconds of exercise as hard as you possibly can. Do jumping jacks, run sprints for 60 seconds. And then this is their lactate at 0 minutes after, all the way to 40 minutes after. This is lactate in milliequivalents or millimole per liter, not a milligram per deciliter. We'll get to that, but milliequivalents. So normal is less than 2 milliequivalents per liter. So down here. And you can see that healthy individuals, 10 minutes after 60 seconds of exercise, sometimes hit as high as 25 milliequivalents of lactate. It's a lot of lactate. We will show you a little bit about what happens in mitochondrial disease on the next slide, but this is just this is so important to me, A, because sometimes we used to do this diagnostically all the time. Everyone used to know this. In the exome era, we don't do this diagnostically anymore, so people don't know that this is normal. And so I've definitely had very healthy athletes come send to me and like they're totally fine, but they went to an exercise like fitness clinic and they said that their lactate was 16. And I'm like, yeah, that's actually normal. It's okay, don't worry. The other reason that I like to show this is that parents come to me very understandably upset and they say, Dr. Smith told me that a lactate of 16 is going to fry my kid's brain. And I say, go run up and down the hallway for 60 seconds and your lactate will be 15 and it will not fry your brain. I'm scared. I'm worried with you. I will help you. But the lactate will not directly fry your kid's brain. I wish I could prevent other doctors from saying that. It's my life goal. So, when is lactate physiologically high? We're talking about physiologic lactate. You just ate a lot because that's a way that the liver can share with other tissues, or the electron transport chain isn't working. It could not be working because of low oxygen, because of exercise, or because of low oxygen, because of hypoxia. And in either of those cases, the high NADH is good because it helps the lactate become a substrate for glucose to come back from the liver so that those tissues can have energy. Excuse me. Sorry about that. And then in patients with mitochondrial disease, lactate can be high because their ETC isn't working. And this is also sometimes good because it allows for regeneration of NAD, that uncharged battery. And you're like, why? Why do I need NAD? Well, we actually have so little NADH in our cells, NAD and NADH in our cells, that if NADH is high, NAD is low. And it can become so low that then we can't burn these other metabolites for energy. Because all of those, burning any metabolite requires NAD to be the place that receives this electron. And so when NAD is low, our body makes lactate to regenerate NAD plus so that it can use NAD plus to break down these other metabolites. Lactate isn't toxic. But many of these other metabolites are. A lot of the ones that I listed actually aren't, but long chain hydroxy fats are kind of the canonical classic example that those are really toxic for you. We know they accumulate in patients with primary mitochondrial disease. We know they accumulate because NAD plus is high. And if we prevent lactate from acting as a reductive molecule to regenerate NAD plus, we then won't be able to oxidize these toxins and get rid of them. And so building up lactate is an important mechanism to regenerate NAD plus, and this is called reductive stress. The last thing that I'll say about why lactate is good and why we have it sometimes is that it is a message, right? This is a little vintage messenger pigeon, right? It's a message that happens between cells. And so what this is showing you is in exercise or in hypoxia, that you make lactate and it feeds back. It feeds back on the hypoxia-inducible factor. It helps increase glucose uptake. And over here, it's showing that in settings of exercise, it can really feed back on the PGC1 alpha, which is a cell survival pathway. And so lactate is sending a message: hey, this is the state of the body right now. The cells are deep inside you, right? They're tiny little things. How do they know what's going on? They know what's going on because they receive messages like lactate. So I've just said a lot of great things about lactate, why it's such an amazing molecule and we all love it. We need it to live. And yet, in patients with mitochondrial disease, lactate causes a lot of fear. And it actually can be dangerous. And so the question is lactate good or is it bad? And how do I know? So physiologic lactate that everyone gets, has the following characteristics. It is a short-lived phenomenon happening in response to an environmental trigger like eating or exercise or actually also fasting. It sends an abrupt cell signal that says, hey, something's happening. It enacts a change. And then that change happens, and you adapt to the situation. And then the situation, which is short-lived, passes. That is good. Like, full stop, that is good. We need that. Pathologic lactic acid elevations are chronic. The lactate is now persistently high. That can cause some non-adaptive responses where the body's like, I'm trying to deal with a short-term situation. Like, what's happening, right? Like, the burnout of the cell, where it's saying, I went full all out for 60 seconds, and you're just living like this. Like, that's not okay. On the flip side, we don't fully understand how lactate is involved in all cell signaling pathways and how all cell signaling pathways interact with mitochondrial disease yet. And so there may actually be adaptive cellular responses that are like, here's alternate ways to get energy. Here's a way to restore NAD plus that are good that we might lose if we lower lactate too much. Lactate is an acid. It can cause acidosis. Acidosis needs to be managed. So I would say lactic acid is neither good nor bad. In some patients, it is bad. In others that we don't fully understand yet, it might be okay or even good. And just to say, I'm going to talk about pathologic lactic acid for several slides. I'm not just meaning in mitochondrial diseases. I've here only talked about mitochondrial respiratory chain diseases. Obviously, disorders of the TCA cycle and pyruvate metabolism can have lactic acidosis. Other metabolic diseases like fatty acid oxidation can have lactic acidosis. Diabetes can have lactic acidosis, hypoxia, and other disease states. Lactate is not a toxin. If I ever get a tattoo, it's going to say lactate is not a toxin. There's no level at which lactate acutely is causing disease. People come to my clinic saying that someone told them that all the time. Lactate scares doctors because doctors are scared of hypoxia and they learn to associate hypoxia and lactate and then they become scared of lactate. That's a reasonable fear. Lactate is scary because it's trying to tell us that something is happening. And you, like, right? It's like if someone calls you and they're like, something's wrong. You get scared. It's not the person calling you that's the problem. It's the something that's the problem. In this case, it could be mitochondrial disease. And just to say, these are other things that cause elevations of lactate. So you eat a carbohydrate meal, a healthy person's lactate might go as high as 4, then stay there for up to 2 hours after a high carbohydrate meal. This is someone who got perioperative steroids. And so you're seeing glucose and lactate. I'm sorry, this is a little too small to read. But what you're seeing is lactate again is going up to 4 or 5 after a steroid course. So lactate always goes up and down. It levels, there's no level at which it is causing disease, right? You're not like, oh my God, you ate a pixie stick and now you're going to have a seizure. Lactate doesn't do that. But so two things. One is that all those things that I just said that make lactate go up in healthy people make lactate go up in people with mitochondrial disease. Steroids, fasting, exercise, carbohydrate load always will go up in mitochondrial disease. What's different about people with mitochondrial disease is that the lactate goes higher and it stays high longer. So this is just exercise. And what you're seeing this lower, they were told to do 7 steps of exercise. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 out of the 7 steps. A healthy person, and this is the percentage by which their lactate goes up. So there's no units in which 100 of lactate is normal. This is 100% of their normal level. So their lactate triples as they take these 7 steps. And then 45 seconds later, it's back down to normal, healthy individuals. Cool. Patients with mitochondrial disease. Again, their starting level could be higher. We'd normalize this all to 100%. Whatever they start at, whether that's 2 or 5 or 15, they take these 7 steps, step one, step two, step three, step four. So it gets higher and higher and higher with actually very little exercise. Instead of here where it like, oh, I'm exercising, it's nice and level. Gets as high as 700% higher than their baseline. And then 65 seconds later, it's still 250% of their baseline. And we could track this out. It'll probably take close to an hour to fully normalize again. So that's one of the ways in which people with mitochondrial disease have differences in lactic acidosis. Longer time to norm, continuous rise, higher peak. We don't know that any of this is true. This is all a theory. This is a very, very nice review article by Wang et al. That I pulled from the American Journal of Physiology. That's asking the question we've said for a long time, no level at which lactate is toxic. Lactate is not an acute toxic. But if you're constantly getting the signal, my lactate is high, something's wrong, does that change how your body functions? And what they're showing you is that lactate can attach itself to histones. Histones are the proteins around which our DNA coils. And whether lactate is attached to them, it changes how much the genes are expressed from those areas of the genome. And so what this is showing you is that in physiologic lactate, you have some types of lactylation that cause some inflammation, increase lipid metabolism, increase oxidative phosphorylation, and maybe increase skeletal muscle function. But that in disease, maybe the lactylation causes mitochondrial dysfunction, muscle dysfunction. It decreases lipid metabolism and promotes lipid storage. It causes a chronic promotion of inflammation. And there's an increase in glycolysis over oxidative phosphorylation that starts ramping itself up. We don't know. That's a theory. But it's part of the reason that we wonder, should we be trying harder to lower lactate? So first of all, how do you know? Is it pathologic lactate or not? So the first question I always ask when someone calls me with a lactate is it real? Recheck the lactate, right? On ice, a free-flowing draw so that you don't have local hypoxia. Check 3 to 4 hours after a meal because we know it goes up with carbohydrates, up with steroid, up with fasting. Not on steroids, not recent exercise. Recent exercise, remember, even for healthy individuals, you can stay high for an entire hour after 60 seconds of all-out exercise. So really like far from exercise. And then use the right units. The number of times that I've talked people off a ledge because a lactate is 30 milligrams per deciliter, So there are 9 milligrams per deciliter to each millimole per liter. So normal is less than 2 millimole per liter, and normal is also less than 18 milligrams per deciliter. So always double check. If you have a, it's the first thing I check when someone gives me a double digit lactate. You can measure how well lactate is over time. If there's high lactate in the urine, that tells you lactate has been consistently high over time, as long as there wasn't bacterial contamination in the urine sample, which can happen when the urine sits in the lab, especially if it's a send out lab like Quest or LabCorp and you sent it in the mail and it was warm in the mail. Bacteria from your skin can grow in that urine sample and then there's some lactate. Don't worry. If your lactate in the blood isn't that high, lactate in urine doesn't matter. And then lactate can become pyruvate, can become alanine. So lactate, proline and alanine and their related ratios really helps us understand whether the lactate has been consistently high. So this is a little algorithm that we proposed in 2017, technically for neonates with lactic acidosis, but it works for everyone. And what it tells you is, are they right? Like, are they sick? How high is it? Are there other biochemical diseases? Am I missing another disease? I can use alanine and proline to tell me that it's persistently well. I can use rechecks to show me that it's persistently high. Sorry, I meant persistently high. Don't ever miss an organic acidopathy or a fatty acid oxidation defect because those things are treated differently. And then just to say, we've talked all of this about the relationship between lactate and NADH. But if lactate is high because pyruvate is high, then lactate and pyruvate will become, kind of be high together. That's called the normal lactate to pyruvate ratio or an inappropriately normal lactate to pyruvate ratio. If lactate is high to regenerate NAD, it's going to be proportionally much higher than pyruvate because you're converting the pyruvate into lactate. That's when you suspect a mitochondrial disease. If the ratio is low, you worry about a pyruvate metabolic defect or also a gluconeogenic defect where you can't make glucose out of the lactate and pyruvate. Just to say, I spent a lot of my time on lactic acidosis, but not all pathologic lactic acidosis is mito, and not everyone with mitochondrial disease has pathologic lactic acidosis. I'm very interested in the question of primary lactic acidosis. Meaning patients who present with lactic acidosis as their first and main manifestation of mitochondrial disease. It's quite unusual, but it happens. We did a big 20-year retrospective cohort analysis of patients with primary lactic acidosis. This is work I took on with Ibi El-Sharkawy, who's now at Mount Sinai. We identified 23 children. Turns out in the last 7 years, I have now and probably another 23 children to add. This is a very high lethality. These are very young kids. It usually happens in the neonatal period. In the published literature, 90% of kids who present this way die. In my hands, 75% pass away, which is still much higher than I would like it to be. I get called to see these kids, and sometimes it turns out that they have a fatty acid oxidation defect or other metabolic disease. So it's important not to just jump to the conclusion that it's mitochondrial disease. And it doesn't match mitochondrial disease writ large. They're mostly kids with nuclear mutations. They are much, much, much younger. They're usually neonatal. And they have really unusual features that you wouldn't otherwise associate with mitochondrial disease. So half have congenital structural abnormalities. This is a list. So atrial septal defects, laryngeal clefts, small limbs, corneal opacities, cataract, cortical malformations. So they're very unusual kids, and they usually have onset. I said neonatally, but honestly, they usually have onset prenatally. And what we're showing you here is just many of them have oligohydramnios. Many of them have growth restriction prior to birth. Some of them are premature, and the lethality is very high. And so this is their lactate peaks. You can see that my curve goes up to 37 millimole per liter So we're now talking about if I were to convert that into milligrams per deciliter, we would be well into the hundreds. So very, very, very high lactate. And what you can see is that survival does correlate with lactate, but lactate alone does not predict survival. And we have had patients survive who've had peak lactates in the high 20s. And some of these kids are long-term survivors. Presenting at birth is slightly worse than presenting after birth. The average lactate in this cohort is around 20. Just to show you, we're working hard on trying to figure out who in the neonatal group has lactic acidosis from mitochondrial disease versus from other causes. The lactate does vary to some extent by group. So these are kids with metabolic disease, these are kids with hypoxia, these are kids with heart disease, kids with infection, and other. Lactate is significantly the highest in kids with metabolic disease. You can see if you picked out any one dot, you couldn't be able to tell what that kid has. And this is telling you that if we use lactate as our only way of measuring, of determining who it is, we're about 65% accurate. And that we care because having a metabolic disease unfortunately predicts the worst survival for kids with neonatal lactic acidosis compared to kids with hypoxia who have a much higher survival. So we built some statistical learning approaches to take in all the metabolic data and other clinical characteristics of this cohort. And you can see here in orange is our computational model and green is lactate alone. And you can see that we were able to train the computer to do slightly better, but meaningfully better so that we can tell people, this is what we think is going on. Okay, so we have lactic acidosis. We've figured out who actually has lactic acidosis, and we've started to characterize the mitochondrial diseases that are most associated with lactic acidosis. How can we treat it? The acidosis can often be severe. People often call me and they're like, I've given two boluses of 1 mL equivalent per kilogram of bicarb, and nothing has happened. Or they call me and they say, I've used acetate, I've used citrate, I've used, lactated ringers, and it's getting worse. So the acidosis is acutely bad. It's hard to manage. This is what tells me that I must manage acidosis. If compensatory respiration, so when we have acid in our blood, we breathe out our carbon dioxide, which is another acid in our lungs, and we breathe it out faster. If people are getting tired from doing that, or they're breathing so fast that they won't be able to keep breathing that fast, you must manage the acidosis right now. Prolonged untreated acidosis, not the lactate, right? The lactate is fine as long as you have buffered the acidosis. But if you haven't buffered the acidosis, the acidosis can cause slowing of the heart, decreased blood pressure, and increased pressure in the lungs, which is called pulmonary hypertension. It can also cause impairment in growth and development over time. Treating acidosis is hard because a lot of the things that doctors use as buffers are things like acetate and citrate and lactated ringers. And they work because we oxidize them in our TCA cycle and we make bicarb in our TCA cycle by oxidizing those things. But remember, I just told you that oxidation, burning metabolites for energy and also bicarb, requires NAD. And if a patient with mitochondrial disease has really high lactate, they don't have the NAD needed to do this. And so they need to be buffered with direct sodium bicarbonate. By the way, if anyone here has pyruvate dehydrogenase deficiency, that's why you can use citrate and pyruvate dehydrogenase deficiency because you're downstream of the block. And then it's great. That's why it's different. The math is a little challenging. This is how I do it. So I calculate the difference between what I want the bicarb to be and what the bicarb currently is. I multiply by the weight and the volume of distribution correction, which is 0.4 or 0.5 in a newborn. I give half in the first 1 to 3 hours, and I give half over the next 24 hours. Lactate is about as strong of an acid as bicarb, the main base in our body, is a base. And so lactate completely explains the degree of acidosis if the number of lactate in millimoles equals the deficit of the bicarb, the delta bicarb in millimoles. So that's how I ask myself, is this just lactic acidosis, or is this a combined lactate and ketoacidosis, or lactate and renal tubular acidosis, all of which can happen with mitochondrial disease? Just to say, we have a calculator that's now been published by Dr. Demsko and our group and others. It's available on the web. It's an Excel sheet where you can put in someone's bicarb and it will calculate for you how to replace it. And then it will tell you whether that's too much sodium or not. This has been great. Bicarb is my mainstay of treatment. The other thing that I use a lot is dichloroacetate. I use it with support from SAIL as part of an emergency IND for kids with life-threatening lactic acidosis. This is the first case that I ever used it in. It was a patient with Pearson syndrome. DCA or dichloroacetate works by activating the pyruvate dehydrogenase. And so it pushes pyruvate through into the TCA cycle. And then because pyruvate gets depleted in patients with mitochondrial disease, that pulls the lactate down. Does that generate more NADH? Yes, it does. I'm not gonna lie, right? So we're now losing that reductive stress, which might be good in some ways. But it's necessary when the lactate has become so high that we can't buffer it anymore. And you can see here how this lactate has come down very nicely in this patient. It has not normalized. Blue is the normal range, but he was up at 25 or so millicolons per liter. And within 7 days of starting dichloroacetate, we got him down to about 5 millicolons per liter, which is a very bufferable number. So this is our cohort over the last 11 years that we've been treating in emergency INDs with dichloroacetate. And you can see that in each case, it significantly lowers the lactate. This is our survival outcomes. This is a very young cohort. We don't have a huge treated group. So you can see that there's no significant decrease in change in survival. You can see this gap right here. That's actually a 95% confidence interval in survival in these first several days of life. And so two-thirds of kids in our treated cohort survived to NICU discharge to go home and see their families. And that's really important. Can we treat the root cause, right? This is a reductive stress. The problem is not lactate. The problem is that NADH is too high. And so the other thing people try is NAD plus generating agents like niacinamide riboside. Question is, can they improve lactate? In my hands, I've honestly never gotten them to improve lactate, but that's okay because lactate isn't toxic. Lactate is a message, and the message it's telling me is NAD is too low. And so I still, when I see high lactate, I respect that message. And I respond to it by giving agents that I think will increase the NAD abundance. Treat the right root cause, just to say, mitochondrial disease patients are complicated. There's a lot of things going on. And so before I just say, oh, it's metabolic, I'll give my metabolic meds, I make sure, am I missing another message that the lactate is trying to tell me? Am I missing that the heart is involved? Am I missing that the gut is involved? Am I missing a serious infection? Am I missing that someone had a seizure and during the seizure, the muscles got hypoxic and the lactate got high? Those are all really important questions to ask. Don't shoot the messenger. People come to me all the time. They're like, I'm having a lactic acid crisis. I'm like, how do you know that you're having a lactic acid crisis? And they say, you know, I'm having more seizures. I'm like, okay, your lactate is high because you are having more seizures. Most symptoms are from the mitochondrial disease. They aren't from the lactate. And so my goal is not to lower the lactate. My goal in most cases is to make the mitochondrial disease better. Lactate can cause problems directly. The acidosis can cause tooth and bone demineralization. It's really important to me. If any of my patients are here, you know that, like, when did you last see the dentist is a conversation I have every single time I see my patients. Some patients do get nausea with high lactate, even if I buffer it. Some patients do feel especially leg pain, but other muscle pain with high lactate, even when I buffer it. And so those are reasons that you can go ahead and blend the lactate. But otherwise, if you're having a crisis, my question is always, what has happened to your mitochondrial disease to make it worse? Not, can we make the lactate go down? So conclusions. Intermittent lactic acidosis is not bad, and it may even be good by causing an adaptive response from our body. Lactate does not directly cause symptoms, but it is an acid and it needs to be buffered. Buffering it can be life-saving in some cases. The main role of lactate is to send a message about the health of the cell. Prolonged distress signaling may be part of what causes long-term disease symptoms. We're still trying to figure that out. That's still speculative. Lactate is also sending a message that really helps us make the diagnosis of mitochondrial disease, and it helps us direct treatments and figure out which of the mitochondrial disease treatments someone needs. So that's really what I wanted to share with you about lactate. Thank you so much for listening, and I'm so excited to take questions.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I took so many notes. We're very, very excited. Questions are coming in, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. If you haven't put your questions in the chat, feel free to go ahead and do that. We will make sure we try to get to them. One patient said, "I have mitochondrial myopathy with lactic acidosis and have to have anterior cervical dissectomy soon." So it's my first surgery. Is there anything I should know before surgery to get better help with the outcome?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what I would say is this. It's important that your surgical team, including your anesthesiologist and the surgeon, know that you have mitochondrial disease, that your lactic acid will probably be higher than other patients, and that if they do things like steroids, fasting, or conversely giving you a lot of dextrose during surgery, all those things may make your lactate go higher. None of those things should make your lactate go dangerously high. On average, they will cause your lactate to be double or triple your normal baseline, which for most people with mitochondrial disease is still a number that's very easy to manage. They should know that they should be monitoring your acid-base status during surgery, and that if they need to ma manage your acid-base status, they should use bicarb rather than lactate or acetate or citrate or these indirect buffers to manage it. That's a lot of information, but what I would say is most people with mitochondrial disease go through surgery well, and their lactate levels stay well controlled during surgery.
Another patient said, "I have MIDD, MIDD form of mito, and after recent anesthesia for operation, my lactate went up to 3.2 mmol. Is there a common outcome for mito patients who require anesthesia?"
Yeah, absolutely. So what I would say is anesthesia makes everyone's lactate go up, but we don't see it in people who don't have mitochondrial disease because their baseline lactate isn't that high in the first place. People with mitochondrial disease, the same things make your lactate go up: anesthesia, exercise, fasting, food, but they go up higher and they stay up longer. So 3.2 is exactly sort of that number in that range where it might be twice your normal or might be 1.5 times your normal amount. And it's a number that looks sort of scary to you, but it's actually a very normal, healthy number. What I'd be looking to make sure is that your level goes back down to normal. And it won't go back down to normal right away. It might take a couple of days.
So when as a clinician do you get nervous that it's longer but not like too long? Do you have like a kind of a range in your mind where it's like a precipice?
I do, but it depends on a lot of things. It depends on how long the anesthesia was. It depends on specifically what anesthetics were used. And also, knowing if you're doing like a lot of physical therapy or rehab, or if you were deconditioned by the surgery, and now the things that you were doing that didn't count as exercise, like walking around your house, are counting as exercise for you. All those things can prolong your recovery from anesthesia. What I would say is, for most routine cases, a week after you're fully back to your baseline is when I'd expect lactate to be normal again.
How often should patients have their lactic levels be monitored? So this is a very broad question. So maybe like there's like multiple ways to go about that. For the patient that maybe is currently in lactic acidosis or whatever and in the hospital, or maybe a patient that has these peaks of lactic acid levels, like how do you approach that as a clinician?
So for me, I really think of my patients with mitochondrial disease in a couple of categories. There's patients whose lactate may be high, but they, and one of the things that I didn't say is that lactate levels less than 5 usually don't cause acidosis. And so for patients whose lactate levels can go high, but they stay less than 5, they haven't really ever needed bicarb for it. I measure their lactate whenever I see them, whenever I do other labs, but like there's no real tempo, just to know what the baseline is why I do it. So, if you're seeing your mito doctor once a year is fine. If you're seeing your doctor, every 6 months. Then a second group of kids is kids where, or adults where lactate level is fine. It's less than 5, but it goes high when they're sick. And by high, double digits or whatever. And those people, I'd like to keep an eye on the baseline to make sure it's not creeping up, maybe at least 4 times a year when well. And then I always recommend it when they're sick. When things are actively changing, I'm starting a new med, when someone's sick and they're getting bicarb, I like to check it every time I make a change. So if I check it and I'm like, oh, I have to increase your bicarb in response to that. I'm going to check it. If they're inpatient, I'm going to check it the next day. If they're outpatient, I'm going to check it the next week. And then for my patients who are chronically on bicarb, and I have patients who like go to school and work whose baseline lactates are 10, 15. I check it every time I make a change. So if I check it and their bicarb has to be changed, then I'm going to check it again in a week or two. And then if I'm able to keep them at the same dose, then I usually try to stabilize them out to, every 3 months. But if I'm managing the lactate, then I don't like to go lower than every 3 months.
So the patients that are chronically on bicarb, what form do they take it in?
I usually give people just sodium bicarbonate tabs. I do have some kids who take baking soda, because it's cheap and widely available. And I do have some people who prefer the IV form, which is a liquid. But sodium bicarbonate in whatever form.
There's one patient that mentioned that they're dependent on the IV form to keep their levels where they should be. Is there a reason that one patient might be more dependent on an IV form versus another form? How does that work?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. So when we eat the oral form or put it in a G-tube or an NG tube, what it does is it reacts with our stomach acid, right? We put a base in our stomach, which is filled with acid, and that reaction releases gas, which we can then absorb into our bloodstream and it buffers. Some people don't tolerate that very well, especially if it's a lot of bicarb. I have a lot of patients who really struggle with bloating, especially my babies who've been on bicarb their whole life. They sort of figure it out because that's just how they've always lived. My people who later on in life get acidosis, it can be, and they're taking huge doses of bicarb because I dose it by weight at all weights. So like huge doses of bicarb. They sometimes really can't tolerate the GI impact. And then for reasons that I don't fully understand, some patients really don't buffer well from the oral form. Maybe they, not to be crude about it, but burp up the buffering. Maybe the it doesn't work quite as well if you're on medications that lower the acid of your stomach. Conversely, I have some patients who actually so my patients with renal tubular acidosis, they don't buffer as well with the IV form because they get it in the IV and it just goes straight out from their kidney, from their renal tubule. So it goes both ways.
No, that's really, really helpful because it's helpful to know a little bit as to why like some types work better for other patients. A clinician asked, do we view the same level, i.e. lactate of 10, differently in terms of wanting to buffer it if patient A has it always around this level versus patient B is normally like a 3 or 4, but now is acutely increased?
Yeah, I do. So people who kind of chronically live at 10, a lot of times their respiratory state is set that they're buffering that, and they're doing okay. Whereas if someone who lives at 2 comes in at 10, they're much more likely to be acidotic, and so that's much more of an emergency.
Another patient, they have a child with Pearson syndrome, and they asked, how do we help the ER docs know the details slash calculations of the bicarb when we come in for LA and when they come in to their ER in LA? Should that be included in the ER letter? Or maybe the site that you talked about, could that be included in the ER letter for them
Absolutely.
to?
So the CHOP bicarb calculator is live on the CHOP mitochondrial medicine pathway. That I can't if you Google CHOP mitochondrial medicine or if there's a way that I can provide it to you after this, I'm super happy to do that. And then you can provide it to them. What I will tell you is that it is the vast majority of the time, it is way more bicarb than the ER has ever given before, and they are scared to do it. But it's okay because you're following the bicarb, which is what you're giving. It can be a lot of sodium, and so that's something that you do have to watch out for, especially for kids with Pearson who have other things going on with their electrolytes. And so it's never going to be an exact number. It's always going to be a number that's sort of happening in the context of everything else that's going on. But absolutely, it's totally appropriate to include an attachment to like the calculator.
And maybe what we can do too is we'll get that link after this presentation and we can put it underneath your presentation when we post it.
Perfect.
Yeah. Another patient asked for a child with PDCD on a keto diet, can lactate levels still get high?
Yeah, that's a great question. Most kids with PDCD do not have persistent lactic acid on keto. A few do, especially if they have really severe mutations. Also, sort of the story of my life the last couple of years has been that the keto diet really does require liver maturity. And so in newborns with PDCD, we can sometimes have trouble getting them to start making ketones. And so you can really see lactic acidosis in that group as well. Managing acidosis in PDCD is hard because ketones are also an acid. And so you have to take into account the acidosis from ketones and the acidosis from lactate when you're deciding how much to buffer.
Another patient asked, is there evidence that subclinical mitochondrial dysfunction and the absence of identifiable genetic mutations can contribute to delayed or intermittent metabolic abnormalities, such as those seen with lactate?
Huh, that's a really interesting question. I would say, yes, we know that there's differences among the general population and how much mitochondrial function ha works. And so there's a range of mitochondrial function. And that you can, this probably does account for some of the natural variation in how much lactate people have, how much exercise it takes to reach your lactate threshold, how prolonged your lactate stays after exercise. And other variations like that. I'm a little hesitant to even call that dysfunction. Some of that is probably dysfunctional, but other of that can also be adaptive changes that have happened to people based on their ancestral access to climate, to oxygen, to diet. And so it might have been adaptive in a certain moment in evolution and be less adaptive now.
So this kind of goes with that, and you kind of touched on it, but just in case there's anything you'd like to add, the same person asked, how are current models accounting for delayed multisystemic effects that may arise from mitochondrial quality control overload rather than acute toxicity?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that that's a really good question. I would say I don't have an answer for that in terms of lactate. One of the things that research is being done on right now is looking at how lactylation, so the addition of lactate to histones, is working in cell signaling and ultimately in mitochondrial quality control. I would say that work is still quite young. We first need to figure out how much lactylation occurs and how much lactylation contributes to those things happening. But other questions that are still unanswered are how high does lactate need to be, and how chronic does that lactate elevation need to be to cause atypical lactylation? And also, are there genetic variations in lactylation? We know that there's genetic variations in other post-translational modifications, how we add them and how we clear them. And so, is that also contributing?
So there's some questions in here about diet. A patient with Pearson syndrome asked, should primary mitochondrial disorders be avoiding carbs if they have a higher baseline of lactate? Are there other dietary considerations?
Yeah. So this is a really important question, and it is a controversial question. I will tell you my opinion, and then you will understand that it is my opinion and not necessarily the law. Lower carbohydrate diets will lower lactic acid, but the lactate itself is not the problem. The lactate is a message that there's not enough NAD to keep going through oxidation. Some people do try to put patients on low carbohydrate or even ketogenic diets when they see lactic acidosis to bring the lactate down. The problem with that is to oxidize fat for energy, you also need NAD. And to oxidize ketones for energy, which is what you make from fats, you also need NAD. We know that people with mitochondrial disease do not oxidize the ketones as well. We see that high beta-hydroxybutyrate to acetoacetate ratio as a diagnostic ratio. More concerningly to me is that we also know, and this is work especially by Rohit Sharma and Bhamsamutha's group, that you can see the increase in long-chain hydroxy fat in patients with mitochondrial disease. And long-chain hydroxy fats are toxic. They are acutely toxic to the heart and to the muscle. And so, maybe not at the levels that you see it in mitochondrial disease. Definitely in LCHAD, it's true. But you could debate whether or not they're at toxic levels. Therefore, I personally do not use low carbohydrate diet, ketogenic diet in my mitochondrial patients because I worry about ketones and long-chain hydroxy fat accumulation and the ketoacidosis and the inability to really utilize ketone for energy. But other people have looked at the same data and do choose to use low carbohydrate diet. So I would say, usually what I tell people is, look, it's a funnel. You don't have very much NAD. It's hard for things to get through. You have the option to use three funnels, to use carbohydrates and fat and protein. And so if things are going through slowly, at least they're going through slowly in three separate locations. And that is usually my diet advice, is something that's really nice and robustly well balanced so that your slow systems can each, no one thing is building up too high.
That's so helpful. Thank you for breaking that down. And I love the funnel analogy and picture. That's super helpful. This patient says, I'm an adult with primary carnitine deficiency. On several occasions while hospitalized with infections, my lactic acid levels were very high and my serum pH was low. Yet I wasn't given any treatment for this, even when it persisted for 2 weeks or longer. Should this be managed or is it just a lab abnormality?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it sort of depends on how high your lactic acid was and how low your pH was. For people who are hospitalized with infection, almost everyone in the hospitalized setting, their lactate should be high, right? That's that acute stress where you want a physiologic reaction. The lactate is telling your body, hey, rally, hey, do this. And I would generally not try to decrease lactate in that setting because it's sending a really important message. What does need to be managed is making sure that your pH is corrected. Hospitals are really good at doing that. So I don't know whether they're giving you medicine for that. If you needed a breathing tube, they actually sometimes also will just change the rate of breathing to keep the pH normal. But that's something that it's in general, hospitals are very good at monitoring for, but it is important to make sure that it stays normal.
Another clinician asked if a patient is walking through a hospital to get the lab done, do we recommend patients rest before having lactate drawn? Since for a mito patient, just traveling to the lab could count as exercise and cause an increase?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I would say if you're rushing to the hospital, to the lab, or you're walking and you usually use a wheelchair, or you had to take a flight of steps and you usually wouldn't do that, I would recommend resting. If you're walking to the lab, but you also walk at work or walk at school, or, yes, it's exercise, but it's what you're doing all day, every day, I'd rather just know what it is because that's your baseline and that I need to know. So I would say treat it as normally as you possibly can.
This question might be a bit specific, so answer it in the way that you can, but I want to give you all the specifics just to kind of give you a broad overview. This patient has M.3260A greater than G. And they ask, why is my base lactate high 6? I'm not overly active. Why am I dependent on 4-LIV to keep it level? The hospitals have tried to wean me off, but this did not work, and I pile to Don, but spike up and I feel very sick and unwell. What could be a cause for lactate to randomly spike when I'm not overdoing it? So I know you don't know this patient. I know you can't give medical advice, but maybe there's like some things that you can kind of pull that would help this patient bring to our doctor in a different way.
Absolutely. So what I would say is people with mitochondrial disease can have very high baseline lactates. And it's both, I would say both things are true. Both you can have a very high baseline lactate just because your mitochondria are not using the NADH. And so your cells need to regenerate lactate in order to do the other things that they need to do. It can also be true that even when you're not overdoing it, patients with mitochondrial disease, a little bit of exercise can make your lactate go much higher from your baseline. And again, remember, that's a percentage of your baseline. So if your baseline is 3 and a healthy person's lactate would double, your lactate is going to go up sevenfold. Like that's a really high lactate and it'll take a while to come down. And so you can see both of those things, exactly as we said with the last question, which I thought was so well spoken. Some people with mitochondrial disease, because your muscles don't work as well, not overdoing it counts as exercise. And those are all reasons. IV fluids and hydration are tools that can make lactate go down in some people, but I would just, the fact that that's something that's consistently being used by this person, what I would say in general is one question that I'd always have in the back of my mind is making sure that we're not missing other causes for lactic acidosis. And so just to say that in the, I hadn't said it yet, but in the healthy population, dehydration and impaired kidney excretion of lactate can also cause lactic acidosis. And so that's something also to keep in mind.
And a question like for countries that aren't doing newborn screening for fatty acid oxidation disorders, is that a possibility as well or no?
Yeah, so absolutely. In kids with fatty acid oxidation defects, you can see really high lactates. The lactate levels really overlap. And in the newborn period before newborn screening has come back, I've personally mistaken long-chain fatty acid oxidation defects from mitochondrial disease multiple times.
So, can monitoring baseline lactate levels over time be a measure at all of progression of mitochondrial disease?
It's a good question. The answer is yes, but it's a very crude measure because so many things affect your lactate level. And people with mitochondrial disease can have disease progression without their lactate going up. And you can have elevated lactate because your nutritional status is better. And so you have more, I see this a lot, not to just hammer on Pearson, which we've talked about a lot, but kids with Pearson can have hypoglycemia. And when they were currently hypoglycemic, their lactate is not actually that high because they don't have enough carbohydrate to make lactate out of. And so their lactate going up over time is actually great. It tells me that I've controlled their hypoglycemia. And like, I'm thrilled. I'm so excited when I see that. So that's like, I would say one piece of evidence where yes, you can use lactate to measure progression over time, but it's one line of evidence that you have to put in the context of the whole person.
So you've talked a lot about that lactate is a symptom, that it's not, it can't, it doesn't necessarily cause disease. This patient asked, can a stroke-like episode be caused by high lactate? Or and they put in specific, like over 20 mLs, or is again that a symptom?
Yeah, so a, one disease in which we know that lactate can be a marker of overall wellness is MELAS. And that in, especially with 3243 MELAS, we know that lactate is usually high when people are having a stroke. And it's a sign of the stroke. It doesn't cause the stroke. And so I would say the same thing in this case, that lactate never causes an acute stroke, but it often is high in patients with mitochondrial disease while they're having a stroke as a sign of the stroke.
Okay, sorry. Okay, so another question, if you're an older patient and you have and the sodium bicarb is too much sodium, can magnesium bicarb be used?
Absolutely. So the important thing is the bicarb, which is the negative ion or the anion. You can put that in with sodium, you can put that in with magnesium, you can put that in with potassium. All of those things are fine. The things that I watch for is not to make the sodium too high. Definitely not to make the potassium too high, because too high potassium is very dangerous. And then if you want to use magnesium bicarb, some people have GI symptoms with magnesium, so just to keep an eye out for that. Actually, many of my patients with mitochondrial disease love magnesium because it does help move the bowels, which a lot of my patients need. Some people, magnesium bicarb, you're not going to get that much magnesium. Just to say, some people feel a little bit of hypotonia with magnesium. So if that's you and you've taken magnesium bicarb and now all of a sudden you're feeling like I'm not as strong as I used to be, don't panic. It's the magnesium and we'll find another ion.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ganeski. Thank you for answering all of our questions. To the audience, you had amazing questions today. Thank you for asking your questions. Thank you for diving into this topic with us and keeping us informed and up to date, and for all the research that you're doing to help us better understand lactic acid and lactic acidosis as well.
Thanks so much for having me. Obviously, I love talking about this stuff. I love helping demystify lactic acid. And I'm so honored to have been invited. And I've had s just really, really enjoyed all the really thoughtful and interesting questions.
Well, have a wonderful day, and thank you everybody for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing people soon.